KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
We were quite literally running around the building trying to figure out what to do with these studies because we weren't going to be allowed back the next day.
The Trump administration's cuts to a government health agency has researchers worried about long-term impacts. For Friday, May 2nd, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. President Trump has issued an executive order to cease federal funding for NPR and PBS.
But it's not clear whether the president has the legal authority to do so.
Also, the deportation of migrants to a prison in El Salvador is raising legal questions that were also asked after 9/11.
Whether they were an Al-Qaeda member or some kind of sympathizer, they all had a right to due process.
Plus, an endurance car race with a twist. The cars cannot cost more than $500.
We're trying to fight to keep the car out there and keep it running, and that's about it.
Those stories and more after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Hurst. College leaders are responding to President Trump's repeated threats to revoke Harvard University's tax-exempt status. As Kirk Carapeza of member station GBH reports, on social media today, Trump resurfaced the idea, saying it's what they deserve.
To be clear, the president does not have the authority to single-handedly revoke an organization's tax-exempt status. But Catherine Bond Hill, the former president of Vassar College, says Trump's threat shows that some policymakers have lost sight of college's service to the public good.
They do this through research, groundbreaking research, but also through educating undergraduates and graduate students that add to our country's pool of human capital.
Hill says some of Trump's criticisms of Harvard and higher ed in general are valid, and schools need to address them. Harvard did not immediately respond to requests for comment. For NPR News, I'm Kirk Carapeza in Boston.
In a statement, a Harvard spokesperson says there's no legal basis to rescind the school's tax-exempt status, which supports its educational mission. European Union regulators are fining TikTok $600 million for sending users' personal data to China. NPR's Bobby Allen reports it's the largest ever penalty imposed under EU digital privacy laws.
Regulators in Europe say TikTok has weak safeguards in place to protect millions of users across the 27-nation bloc from having their sensitive data sent to Beijing. The $600 million fine came under the EU's General Data Protection Regulation. TikTok responded by saying the EU is focused on a select period before new data safety measures were enacted. TikTok says it has never sent Europeans' data to Chinese officials. The crackdown in Europe comes as TikTok's future in the U.S. remains uncertain. The video app is now banned under federal law, but the Trump administration is not enforcing it and instead is pushing for a deal that would have American investors take over TikTok's U.S. operations. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Employers added slightly fewer jobs in April, but still more than analysts were expecting. The Labor Department says employers added 177,000 jobs last month. This is President Trump's trade war started to weigh on the wider economy. NPR Scott Horsley has more on where the jobs are.
Some of the jobs are coming in industries that are pretty well insulated from the ups and downs of the economy, like healthcare. That saw the biggest job gains last month. And, you know, hospitals are generally pretty recession-proof. But restaurants and bars are not recession-proof, and they also added about 17,000 jobs in April. That was not a given, especially after we got some worrisome reports this week about a drop in U.S. sales at restaurants like McDonald's and Domino's Pizza.
NPR Scott Horsley reporting. The unemployment rate held steady at 4.2%. Wall Street higher by the closing bell, the Dow up 564, the Nasdaq up 266. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. A research team has developed a new approach they say could one day lead to a universal anti-venom against venomous snakes. NPR's Ari Daniel has more.
Many snake species produce venoms that can be harmful or deadly to humans, but they don't all work the same way. Jacob Glanville, the CEO of the company Centivax, wondered about producing a universal antivenom by finding a person who'd been exposed to lots of different venoms. He eventually found someone who'd been bitten some 200 times.
If anybody has broken through the problem of getting the immune system to focus, it's this guy.
Glanville scoured this man's blood for antibodies that neutralized multiple venoms. And when he and his team combined two of the best ones, along with another molecule, the result offered mice complete protection against multiple species of venomous snakes from all over the world. Soon, the researchers plan to expand their coverage to include vipers. Ari Daniel, NPR News.
Amid tariff uncertainty, more gamers are facing price hikes, including Microsoft, which is raising prices on its Xbox consoles and controllers. The Xbox Series S rose $80 to just under $380, and the more powerful Xbox Series X is now $100 more expensive at nearly $600. The tech giant didn't mention tariffs specifically, but it did cite wider market conditions and the rising cost of development. Also, prices some of the accessories, including wireless controllers and headsets, are going up. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at MelvilleTrust.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Elsa Chang. President Trump's latest target in his battle against mainstream news outlets is public broadcasting. Late last night, he issued an executive order to pull federal funds from both NPR and PBS. Today, the networks vowed to fight back. Here with more is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, who joins us now. Hi, David.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so before we begin, let's just note, as we always do, no NPR executive has been involved in our coverage of this network, right?
Right, and I'm covering this. I'm not speaking for the institution here.
Exactly. Okay, so tell us why President Trump says he wants to end federal funding of NPR and PBS.
Well, in his executive order, he accused NPR and PBS of ideological bias. And social media postings, he's gone even further. He's called NPR and PBS the radical left monsters that so badly hurt our country. But it's impossible to look at this and not see it fitting in neatly to this broader assault, essentially, on the news media writ large through actions by his regulators to investigate all the major broadcasters except that owned by Rupert Murdoch, to do lawsuits privately as an individual citizen, really try to upend credibility, legal standing, the finances, you name it.
Okay. And in this executive order, just spell out exactly what Trump is ordering with regard to NPR and PBS here.
Well, he's decreeing, or saying anyway, that he's decreeing that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting can't send any money to NPR and PBS, but more that the stations that really received the lion's share of funding from the federal taxpayer, about $535 million a year, they can't send any money back to us, to NPR and PBS either. You know, I want to be clear, it's not at all certain that Trump has the authority, even as president of the United States, to do this. This was an institution, this Corporation for Public Broadcasting, set up by Congress decades ago with the intention that it be insulated from pressure from government officials and government employees. It's right there in federal statute. And in fact, the president, although he gets to appoint the members of the board of the CPB, there's no mechanism for him to remove them, which he also tried to do earlier this week. It appears as though he's trying to really hit NPR and the stations to try to squeeze them to make sure that NPR and PBS don't have standing to receive money to be viewed as credible. But, you know, depending on how this works, it could have a huge impact also on the local stations themselves. They would have hours to fill. Their two biggest expenses are paying for local reporters and staff and paying for programming from NPR itself.
Right. Okay, well, what are the networks and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting saying in response as of now?
Well, they have some pretty tart words for this. PBS's chief executive and president, Paula Kerger, called it blatantly unlawful. PBS, I might add, receives about 15% of its revenues each year directly from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting itself seems to have essentially ignored this. It doesn't seem to be granting it the standing as being legitimate, and it's already suing the president and the White House over his efforts to remove three of their board members. NPR has said that this would jeopardize the national airing of shows like Morning Edition and Tiny Desk Radio and a whole host of others, people here on this station and others around the country, and says that NPR is committed to fighting bias as best it can. In fact, it engaged in a major new initiative funded by the CPP to start doing that just last year.
That is NPR's David Folkenflik. Thank you, David.
You bet.
As President Trump and Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. have promoted their Make America Healthy Again agenda, they've repeatedly brought up the danger of harmful chemicals.
We're going to get toxic chemicals out of our environment.
That's Trump back in August.
We're going to get them out of our food supply. We're going to get them out of our bodies.
At the same time, the Trump administration is dismantling an agency that spends much of its energy on exactly this type of work. NPR's Will Stone reports.
Catherine Blackwood had spent the past 3 years investigating the health effects of prolonged mold exposure, and her new experiment was all ready to go when the email came through.
We just had to stop everything where it was.
Blackwood works for the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, NIOSH for short.
We were quite literally running around the building trying to figure out what to do with these studies because we weren't going to be allowed back the next day.
Altogether, the agency is expected to lose about 900 employees, roughly 90% of its workforce, by the end of June. And staffers like Blackwood are wondering if years of work can be salvaged.
It's just gone. We don't have access to any of the data. We don't have access to any of our anything.
Other scientists describe a similarly chaotic shuttering of the agency. Biological samples lost, research animals donated to other labs or euthanized, long-running studies abandoned overnight.
Abandoned is a good word. There wasn't a shutdown. A shutdown implies, you know, an orderly procedure.
That's Kyle Mandler. He's a toxicologist who'd been studying a fatal lung disease linked to silica dust in the countertop industry.
We were really in the middle of working to try and understand what is inherent in this material that's, you know, potentially so deadly for these workers.
NIOSH is part of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Its mandate to prevent injury, illness, and death in the workplace touches many sectors. The cuts to programs for coal miners and firefighters provoked strong backlash, even from some Republicans. But the firings will have far broader consequences.
It's almost destroyed.
Dr. Robert Harrison is a professor at the University of California, San Francisco. He says NIOSH is instrumental in identifying and preventing harmful chemicals and toxic substances in American life.
The cuts, I think, will be a devastating loss to our opportunity to prevent cancers in the United States.
Over the years, the agency has advanced research on what are now well-known carcinogens like asbestos, benzene, and vinyl chloride.
As a result of the work that these scientists at NIOSH have done, some of these most toxic chemicals have virtually been eliminated.
In response to NPR's questions, a statement from the Department of Health and Human Services said that critical initiatives under NIOSH will remain intact as the agency continues to streamline its operations and will eventually join Secretary Kennedy's newly created Administration for a Healthy America. But interviews with 12 NIOSH staff indicate key functions are at a standstill. A cancer database for firefighters has stopped enrollment. There's no one running the program that tracks lead exposure in adults or testing and approving personal protective equipment. Many expect the NIOSH funding for universities and states will dry up too. Dr. Philip Landrigan is an epidemiologist at Boston College and a former NIOSH official.
It's all very well and good to talk about streamlining government, but there's no way in the world Mr. Kennedy's new agency for making America healthy again is going to be able to protect workers' health after they've let 90% of the subject matter experts go.
And because of the cuts, NIOSH can no longer take requests to investigate concerning clusters of illnesses or other emerging hazards. States, employers, unions rely on this help. In fact, staff say dozens of ongoing investigations will be left unfinished. Will Stone, NPR News.
The sex trafficking trial of hip-hop mogul Sean Diddy Combs begins in New York City next week. Combs has been in custody since his arrest last September. He has pleaded not guilty to all charges, and the music industry will be watching the trial closely. It wasn't long ago that Combs was being celebrated for his long and influential career. NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento has been following the allegations against him and a warning that this story contains descriptions of sexual assault. Hi, Isabella.
Hi, Sasha.
What exactly is Combs being accused of?
So to answer that, we have to go back a couple of years when Combs was at a real career high. And you may recall his career dates all the way back to the 1990s, so some listeners might know him better as Puff Daddy or P. Diddy. But if we fast forward to 2022, he'd gotten a Lifetime Achievement Award from BET. The next year, New York City Mayor Eric Adams awarded Combs a key to the city. I mean, he was just really on top of his game and getting all of these recognitions for his decades, not just as an artist, but as a key player in the music and media industry. In November 2023, he gets nominated for a Grammy, and then very quickly, his reputation takes a huge hit. Combs' ex-partner, the singer Cassie Ventura, files a civil lawsuit claiming that Combs trafficked, raped, and violently beat her throughout their relationship. She alleges that the abuse went on for over a decade and that Combs' employees helped him cover it up. Now, Combs denies all of Ventura's allegations, but the next day, they settle that lawsuit out of court for an undisclosed amount. And the accusations are so shocking that Combs' reputation just doesn't really bounce back.
Isabella, you said that Ventura filed a civil lawsuit. So explain how Combs has ended up in jail facing criminal charges.
Yeah, that's right. After Ventura comes forward, many, many more people file civil lawsuits against Combs, alleging very similar kinds of abuse. And Combs keeps denying the allegations. But like you said, these are not criminal charges. Then in March of 2024, federal law enforcement agents raid several properties linked to Combs. They confiscate weapons, they confiscate electronics, all sorts of things. And 2 months later, in May, CNN obtains and releases a hotel surveillance video that shows Combs violently kicking and hitting Ventura. It was an incident from 2016, and Combs posts this online.
My behavior on that video is inexcusable. I take full responsibility for my actions in that video. I'm disgusted.
In September of 2024, Combs is arrested in New York City. The federal government charges him with sex trafficking, transportation to engage in prostitution, and racketeering conspiracy, basically alleging that he used his businesses to facilitate and conceal sex crimes dating back more than a decade. There's a description of that hotel incident in the criminal indictment, though it doesn't refer to Ventura by name. And prosecutors point to that video to argue that Combs should not be released on bail because he could behave violently. A judge ultimately sides with them, and Combs remains in custody awaiting this trial.
Once his trial starts next week, give us a sense how it's likely to play out.
Yeah, there are several alleged victims expected to testify against Combs, and those could very well include people who filed some civil lawsuits against Combs. The CNN video will be admitted as evidence. And, you know, Combs' attorneys maintain his innocence. They say that all of these encounters were consensual. But if he is convicted, if the jury finds him guilty of all of the charges, he could spend the remainder of his life behind bars.
That's NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Elsa Chang. During a recent exploration in the deep sea, researchers at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration found a mural that has survived more than 80 years underwater. But this mural had never been photographed in full. It's part of the shipwreck of the USS Yorktown, an aircraft carrier that sank during a key battle in World War II. Phil Hartmeyer is a marine archaeologist at NOAA's Ocean Exploration Program, and he joins us now to talk about this find. Welcome.
Hi, Elsa.
Hi. So just describe what this mural looks like.
Well, the mural is a large format, 42 foot by 14 foot tall map of our entire planet. And it depicts really in stunning color where USS Yorktown has completed its activities, where it's operated, including, lines that are drawn from, the Hawaiian Islands to Midway.
That's so cool. It's a visual history of its trips.
Absolutely.
Do we know who painted the mural and when it was painted? Anything like that?
We don't. And it's such an important part of this mystery where here we have this stark gray warship, right? And then here we have this just beautifully detailed hand-painted mural that we really know nothing about except for what we found 3 miles below the surface.
What a fascinating mystery. I mean, this mural, it was found at the site of a battle, the Battle of Midway, which unfolded just months after Pearl Harbor, right? Why was this mural so important for your team to find?
Well, Elsa, for several reasons. The Battle of Midway was certainly a turning point in the war, and the battle really signified one of the changing historical elements, that trends in naval warfare, and that was this this evolution to battles fought in the air, in the importance of naval aviation. And the mural was often one of the last things that naval airmen and air crews saw as aircraft were getting raised up the elevators onto the flight deck where they'd take off and land. So there's really an incredible sort of emotional component to this, as one of the last things airmen would see is this beautiful hand-painted journey.
Oh, I love that. Well, I know that your team, the way I understand it, you were expecting and looking to find this mural, but did your team expect it to be in such good condition when you approached it?
We didn't. We didn't know what to expect. The maneuver to get the remotely operated vehicles within eyesight to be able to image the mural was very technical, and the descent into the elevator shaft itself had never been done before. This was the first mission that went inside USS Yorktown.
Oh,
so
wow.
There really wasn't much to expect. And then we saw the beautiful blues and the golds and the motifs, and it took our breath away.
Are there conditions about the deep sea that would actually make it more likely that art would be preserved at such extreme depths?
Potentially so. And, every day through these expeditions and deep sea exploration that's being led by NOAA Ocean Exploration and others, we're learning more about the oceanography of these places, the chemistry of the water, and discovering new species, almost every cruise, where the biota and some of these factors that all together make deep sea ecosystems really a thriving environment.
I understand that you may have also discovered a new species of jellyfish while you were exploring this shipwreck. Is that right?
Absolutely. It was a great moment during one of the dives where we're going from parts of the ship, showcasing places where incredible acts of valor took place. And, then this beautiful jelly scrolls across the ROV cameras, and you know, our biologists are just jumping on the line, and no one had seen this before, and
wow.
it just adds to this experience, right, of how little we know about this just incredibly rich environment. And there's new species all over the place. Just have to look.
Yeah, you just have to look. Phil Hartmeyer is a marine archaeologist at NOAA's Ocean Exploration Program. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
The 24 Hours of Lemons is an endurance car race with a major tweak. The cars can't cost more than $500, but teams can decorate them any way they like. Think a black and yellow beetle with a team dressed as bees. NPR's Bill Chappell spent the weekend at a 24 Hours of Lemons race to learn how and why the racers do what they do.
Like a lot of good times, it starts with a block party. Race cars are rolling into downtown Camden, South Carolina, like an old-fashioned circus. Once they park, kids run from car to car. These are not your usual race cars. A Honda Civic has a lawnmower, squirrels, and flamingo on its roof. A cream-colored Toyota Yaris has googly eyes, an homage to Gary Wilson Jr., the snail from SpongeBob SquarePants. In the middle of the party, race judges in black robes sort cars into competition classes. One of the judges is Eric Rude. He tells me it's a back-and-forth process.
It is a bit of a negotiation, yeah. And I'm not above reproach. This is a wagon full of bribery.
The graft in question is beer, food, and novelty items. When a judge approves a car, the word bribed is spray-painted on its hood. The 24 Hours of Lemons started more than 15 years ago in California. It's a take on France's famous 24 Hours of Le Mans. This weekend's race is shorter and spread over 2 days. On a sunny Saturday, cars tear around the track. Matthew Ramirez stands at a fence with his young son, who's a big fan of Gary the Snail. Ramirez is here to see a friend race. He says he isn't into NASCAR.
I think this is pretty cool, though. I like this a lot.
Yeah.
And especially the endurance aspect of just trying to race your garbage as long and fast as possible. I think it's awesome.
These cars cost less than $500 at first, but safety costs are exempt. Every car has a roll cage and fire suppression. And like big time racing, drivers are protected by head and neck restraints. This track is more than 2 miles long. Built over an old airport, it's a mix of straightaways and sharp turns where some drivers spin out. But the biggest challenges are mechanical.
I had apparently boiled the brake fluid.
That's Shelley McKee. She and her husband Justin are here racing a 1978 Datsun B210. It needs a new radiator and fan after rear-ending another car.
Half our team is at the parts store right now getting everything that we need, and we're here bleeding the brakes to try and save that.
It's not easy keeping a lemon rolling. After the first day, some crews are up past midnight helping each other. By Sunday afternoon, about 50 of more than 80 registered cars are still on the track. And that's the goal, McKee says.
We're trying to fight to keep the car out there and keep it running, and that's about it.
Finally, after more than 13 hours of racing, the checkered flag waves. Spectators line up at the track exit, applauding every car. The McKee's Datsun didn't make it to the finish, but they did win an award for having the worst brakes. It's called Can't Stop, Won't Stop. And in a race where the loudest cheers are for teams that defy the odds, that seems about right. Bill Chappell, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Jeffrey Sellers' dad was a process server in Detroit.
I saw people who couldn't pay their monthly bills, who were getting divorced. I saw people who were getting kicked out of their houses.
And there's a line between that and his career as a Broadway producer of Rent and Hamilton. Listen Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
525,600 minutes.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Control of Crimea is a major factor in trying to end the war between Russia and Ukraine.
But it wasn't always called Crimea, and its name has evolved over time.
So the name's not going to have a straight line through history.
That story and more after this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. A little-known trade loophole allowing mail shipments valued under $800 to enter the U.S. duty-free and without custom inspections has been closed by the Trump administration today. The de minimis trade provision was key to the successes of several Chinese companies bringing in cheap goods to American consumers. Aaron Rubin says taxes or tariffs on those goods are going to double. He's the CEO of ShipHero, which helps e-commerce businesses manage their inventory and shipping operations.
All goods you purchase that are of Chinese origin that are shipped in usually small parcels, so Shein and Temu being the most popular places these days selling those goods, but also a lot of Amazon sellers, those goods came in tariff-free until May 1st. Now that on May 2nd, there's going to be a tariff applied. If you go into checkout on Shein and Temu, you'll actually see there's an additional charge of over 100%, so more than doubling of the fee.
This week, the Department of Health and Human Services published a 400-page document evaluating treatments for transgender children. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin tells us the review's authors are not being named.
The report was commissioned by an executive order President Trump signed in January entitled Protecting Children from Chemical and Surgical Mutilation, so it's not surprising that the document is critical of gender-affirming care for young people who identify as transgender, although it acknowledged there is little evidence of harms. Its authors' names are not being made public, HHS says, to protect the integrity of a post-publication peer review process. The American Academy of Pediatrics called the report alarming and said it was not credible and only considered a narrow set of evidence and perspectives. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. West Virginia is leading a coalition of states in a lawsuit challenging Vermont's climate Superfund law. As Curtis Tate from West Virginia Public Broadcasting reports, the Justice Department is taking Vermont and other states to court over their climate laws.
Attorney General J.B. McCuskey and 23 other state attorneys general took Vermont to federal court in a lawsuit filed late Thursday. They're challenging a Vermont law enacted last year that imposes fines on fossil fuel producers for the greenhouse gas emissions they caused over a 30-year period. The states, along with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the American Petroleum Institute, say the law violates the U.S. Constitution. They say Vermont is preempted by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the Clean Air Act from regulating greenhouse gas emissions. Earlier this year, West Virginia sued New York over a similar law. For NPR News, I'm Curtis Tate in Charleston, West Virginia.
Well, federal health officials say measles cases continue to spread around the country, with 29 states now reporting cases. The CDC says Texas remains the epicenter of the measles outbreak with 683 cases since January. The agency says 96% of the cases this year have been in unvaccinated people or those with unknown vaccination status. There have been 3 confirmed deaths this year, and those people were unvaccinated as well. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Trump administration has sent migrants whom they call terrorists to an overseas prison. Many of these migrants have no criminal records, and they're being sent there for indefinite detention. There's no end date. And to some observers, all of this echoes another ongoing chapter in U.S. history, when the U.S. detained foreign citizens that the government called unlawful enemy combatants in a prison at the U.S. Naval Base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, in the aftermath of 9/11. Some were subjected to interrogation techniques that human rights groups call torture.
I think there are superficial parallels. But there are important differences.
This week, I spoke with former Justice Department lawyer John Yoo, one of the legal architects of George W. Bush's Guantanamo policy. He authored what are widely referred to as the torture memos. I wanted to know whether he saw President Trump's El Salvador prison plan as an extension of the legal theory behind the Guantanamo detention program.
President Trump is claiming wartime authority, invoking something called the Alien Enemies Act of 1798. The Bush administration also claimed wartime authority to be able to hold enemy prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. I think after 9/11, not just President Bush, but Congress and the Supreme Court all agreed the 9/11 attacks had started a state of war. Here, President Trump, he is claiming that we're at war with Venezuela, and he is claiming that this gang, Trendel Aragua, is sort of like a military arm of Venezuela. But he has no agreement from any of the other branches. In fact, a federal district court judge just rejected
in Texas
that idea,
saying that the Trump administration's use of the Alien Enemies Act to remove a group of migrants in Texas actually is not proper.
Yes, because there's no state of war. And then the second difference is, no matter whether there was a state of war or not, the Bush administration view, in which I participated developing, was that anyone who was captured in the United States had a right to due process. Whether they were an American citizen or an alien, whether they were an Al-Qaeda member or some kind of sympathizer, and we took the view if they were caught in Afghanistan or in Iraq, they were not entitled to due process in U.S. courts because that had been the traditional practice in war. The Trump administration seems to be taking the opposite view. They think that you could deport people under the Alien Enemies Act who are in the United States without any due process at all. And that is, I think, a challenge to the settled rules that we and the courts came up with in the years after the September 11th attacks.
I was just going to ask you, because yes, the Supreme Court did eventually rule against the Bush administration on some of its policies towards Guantanamo detainees. How confident are you that the Trump administration will eventually heed the courts here?
Part of me worries. I hear President Trump on TV, he says, "We will not defy judicial orders. I will never defy judicial order." At the same time, you have Trump administration officials, you have fellow travelers of President Trump and the MAGA movement say they might defy judicial order or attack the judges, call for their impeachment. So great difference here between the Bush administration. We didn't even think of ourselves as opposed to the courts. We thought of ourselves as working with the courts to figure out what the rules should be, because we wanted there to be stability.
I do want to acknowledge throughout all this that you are known to many people as the so-called author of the torture memos, one of which did say that only pain equivalent to an injury that could result in, quote, death, organ failure, or serious impairment of body functions could be considered torture. And let me just ask you, because there are credible reports of torture in Salvadoran prisons, if you look at a 2023 State Department report, including at least one report that meets the definition in your memos. So, just to underline the point, are there legal issues with sending migrants to prisons in El Salvador when the U.S. government has acknowledged
these conditions?
I have to say, I think the circumstances and the context of what we're talking about after 9/11 and this are very different, but in a way that cuts against the Trump administration. You know, we are talking about a time period when there was very little definition in American law about what torture was. Plus, we were talking about, unfortunately, the ticking time bomb idea that we had terrorists in our custody who knew about pending attacks on the United States and would not tell us what they were, which is a very different world than where do you send immigrants, where do you send aliens, or even how do you hold American citizens in prison. And there, I think the definitions are much clearer. And the way you just described it is, I think, quite accurate. The United States isn't supposed to, under American law, deport people to places where they might be tortured.
John Yoo is a former Justice Department lawyer and a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley. He is also a visiting professor at the University of Texas Austin School of Civic Leadership. Thank you very much for this conversation.
Oh, my pleasure.
The iconic British department store Harrods says hackers tried to breach its systems earlier this week. It's the latest in a recent string of ransomware attacks that have hit major retailers in the UK. Ransomware attacks usually involve hackers blocking access to a company's data and demanding payment to unlock it. Rebecca Rossman reports from London.
The most interesting and beautiful store in the whole of Britain and one of the most famous in the world.
Since opening its doors in 1834, the store's motto has been, quote, all things for all people everywhere.
A busy store in a busy city.
But not so busy this week, when sales took a dent after hackers gained access to the store's systems. As a precaution, the luxury retailer said it had restricted internet access at its sites. Who attempted the breach and why is still unclear. But it comes just days after two other major British retailers, Marks & Spencer and Co-op, also fell victim to cyber attacks.
I've just stepped into a Marks & Spencer in central London to get a bottle of water, and I'm looking at the shelves, and I would say that they're about 20% less full than they should be.
For Marks & Spencer, a popular food and clothing chain, the fallout has been serious. The hack, believed to be linked to a cyber criminal group known as Scattered Spider, disrupted M&S's online store and parts of its supply chain. The result? Millions in losses and some store shelves left noticeably bare. Cybersecurity experts say the attacks highlight just how underprepared many major retailers still are when it comes to defending their digital infrastructure.
People will see it as a wake-up call, but it shouldn't have been a wake-up call.
Rob Pritchard is an analyst who runs the website thecybersecurityexpert.com. He says the industry has long prioritized convenience and cost over real resilience.
You know, like buying a terrible car with no safety features, and then, I don't know, putting in cheap seatbelts.
While Harrods says no customer data has been compromised, the incident is part of a growing global trend. Ransomware attacks have been increasing worldwide, including in the U.S., where hackers have recently targeted government agencies, hospitals, and even public schools. Rebecca Rossman, NPR News, London.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. A federal prosecutor has been sending probing letters to medical journals accusing the publications of political bias. The inquiries are intensifying concerns that the Trump administration is trying to restrict free speech among scientists. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein has more.
The letters began arriving over the last few weeks. Edward R. Martin Jr., the interim U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia, writes that journals are, quote, partisans in various scientific debates, and then asks pointed questions about misinformation, competing viewpoints, funders.
We were surprised.
Dr. Eric Rubin is the editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, one of at least four journals to get a letter from the U.S. attorney.
Other journals had received letters before, so it wasn't a shock, but still a surprise.
Martin has also sent letters to journals published by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the American College of Chest Physicians, and the American Medical Association.
We were concerned because there were questions that suggested that we may be biased in the research we report, and we aren't. We're not politically motivated. We are physicians, not politicians, and we want to maintain that independence to produce the highest quality evidence-based facts that we can. We think we're an antidote for misinformation.
Rubin says the letter mentioned that the journal has tax-exempt status.
It does feel like there's a threatening tone to the letter, and it is trying to intimidate us.
The letter to the journal Chest doesn't describe any examples of supposed bias or say what the U.S. attorney might do. Legal experts say medical journals are protected by the First Amendment, but J.T. Morris, a lawyer for the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, says the letters are still troubling.
We've seen this administration take all sorts of action that doesn't have a legal basis, but hasn't stopped them. And so there's always a concern that the federal government and officials like Ed Martin will step outside and abuse their authority and try to abuse the legal process and abuse the court system into compelling scientific journals and medical professionals and anybody else they disagree with into silence.
The letters come as the Trump administration has been restricting what scientists can say in a variety of ways. The administration has stifled communications by federal scientists, slashed funding for studies about misinformation, vaccines, and LGBTQ issues, and demanded scientists scrub language deemed woke. Richard Horton is the editor of The Lancet, a leading British medical journal. He says he hasn't gotten a letter, but argues medical journals play a crucial role in vetting and disseminating reliable scientific information.
This is a set of policies attacking the scientific community, whether it's scientists in universities or in institutions like NIH, FDA, CDC, or journals and their editors. This is a research ecosystem, and it is the working of that research ecosystem which has delivered these phenomenal breakthroughs over so many decades. And that is what is being attacked.
Neither Martin nor the Justice Department responded to NPR's questions, but others do say medical journals can be biased. Roger Severino is at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank.
They are absolutely biased, and we've seen that they've been captured by what I call a blob, which is a form of gatekeepers that are colluding with big pharma and the public health agencies and academia, and they all know each other. So yes, there has been a lot of bias.
So Severino says he's glad that someone is trying to hold the medical journals accountable. Rob Stein, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. The sports world and science have known for decades that female athletes injure their ACLs more often than male athletes. And tearing that knee ligament can mean surgery and many, many months of rehab. But why are women more susceptible than men? A new study funded by FIFA, soccer's international governing body, will look into whether menstrual cycles play a role. Dawn Scott will be following the study closely. She's a performance coach and applied sports scientist in elite women's soccer. She's worked with the women's national soccer teams in the U.S. and England, and she advises FIFA. And she's with us now to talk about efforts to prevent ACL injuries in women. Hi, Dawn. Thanks for coming on.
Hi. Thank you for the invite.
I realize you're not involved with this study, but help us understand how a woman's period could have any connection to an injury to her knee ligament.
I think that, for me, is a misconception because I think it's much broader than that. Injuries anyway, and especially ACL injuries, are very multifactorial. And I think for many years, we focused a lot on sex differences and hormones, obviously menstrual cycle, period being the hormonal factors. And for the last 10, 20 years, we haven't seen any change in ACL injury rates in females. However, in males, that rate is coming down. So I think we need to go broader than that and look at the full picture of the risk factors and causes of ACL injuries.
Athletes work with coaches to strengthen themselves and work on stabilization, things that will ideally prevent injuries. But this study is interesting because it's suggesting that despite all the training they may do, there could be biological factors that play a role in injuries. And I can imagine that would be quite, it can be quite devastating. An athlete might think I did something wrong when in fact it's about her body. What are your thoughts about that psychological element and how athletes should handle that?
And I think it's the whole education process. Part of the reason girls drop out of sport at a faster rate than boys is because they either don't get education at all in terms of, you know, sex differences and hormones, or they do, but it's not from somebody who has the expertise, the understanding of that. So again, I think it's important that, you know, you look at school curriculums for education so that girls do get that understanding of their bodies and actually at times use the hormones to their advantage. And, you know, are they maximizing potential as females? Because, you know, for all of these years, females, girls have been trained as boys because actually only 6% of the sports science research is totally focused on female athletes, female subjects.
From your coaching perspective, how much could non-biological, non-biomechanical factors play a role in ACL injuries? I'm thinking about type of shoe, type of training, grass versus turf, maybe condition of pitch.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, there's only one real brand, Ida Sports, who design the soccer cleat based on the shape of the female foot. We tend to have a wider front foot, narrower heel. And then I think then it's the interaction between the soccer cleat and the surface. Is the player wearing the right boot for the right surface? So whether that is turf, whether it's grass. And again, does the player have the luxury or the fortune to change or have multiple soccer cleats so that they can change and have the optimal cleat for the right surface?
You've touched on this a little bit, but I think for many parents of young athletes listening and female athletes themselves, they crave specific advice or tips on how to train and play in a way that is most likely to protect their knees. What are your top line pieces of advice for players and their parents?
I think some of it is that injury reduction exercises, strength is important, but then also that recovery piece of sleep, nutrition, hydration, and making sure lifestyle choices and behaviours are optimal to prepare the player going into a training session or game, but then also recover them afterwards.
You know, and in quite a compliment to you, many players on the U.S. women's soccer team say you're a huge part of their World Cup success a few years ago. Because of your perspective and the success you've had with the players you've worked with, what more do you think can be done to support players?
I think education is a massive one. Like I said, part of the reason girls drop out of sport at a faster rate than boys is they're trained as boys, not girls. So I think making some of that education globally accessible, and I think then we start to understand and give the female the best chance to optimize their performance.
That is performance coach and applied sports scientist Dawn Scott. Thank you.
Thank you.
The war in Ukraine has swept the dust of history off the name Crimea. The Black Sea Peninsula was part of independent Ukraine until Russia forcibly annexed it in 2014. Now it's a stumbling block in finding peace. As NPR's Scott Newman reports, even the name itself, Crimea, is a centuries-old mystery.
Doug Harper, who created the online etymology dictionary, says it's not easy tracing the linguistic origins of place names. And Crimea is no exception. In fact, he says, it's a good example of the way those names evolve over time.
It's like the Middle East in some ways. There's layer after layer of this people on top of that people on top of that people. So the name's not going to have a straight line through history.
It wasn't always called Crimea. That name probably wasn't coined until the 14th or 15th century. Anatoly Lieberman of the University of Minnesota says it might derive from a root meaning fortified place or wall. But even he isn't sure.
So the origin is either Turkic or Mongolian, clearly from the east, certainly not Greek, certainly not Slavic, and that is as far as we can go.
It's been three intense years of fighting in Ukraine, and now a Trump administration proposal to end it calls for recognizing the Kremlin's control over the peninsula. But that's something Ukrainian officials say they can never concede. Before this recent fighting, the most people knew about the region was likely from a brief mention of the Crimean War in high school history. Brian Glenn Williams of the University of Massachusetts Dartmouth says it was one of the bloodiest of the 18th century, with
the British and the French and the Turks invading the Crimea and crushing the Russians on their own soil.
The Crimean conflict was the first in which the telegraph and photography were used, but it's probably best remembered today because of an Alfred Tennyson poem.
So you're the famous charge of the Light Brigade, where these brave British cavalrymen formed up in a big formation and charged straight into these Russian cannons, and it became just a bloody massacre.
It marked the end of the cavalry charge and the beginning of modern warfare. Just as today, in Ukraine, drones and cyber attacks signal another turning point in how wars are fought. Scott Newman, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From Workday, Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward.